for this Thursday, the 2nd of December. We're going to be talking about space this hour of the program, and we should have a highly interesting and lively program. After we had booked the show, we discovered yesterday that NASA had set a news conference on an astrobiology discovery that's going to take place, the news conference this afternoon. Their press release says NASA will hold a news conference at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to discuss an astrobiology finding that will impact the search for evidence of extraterrestrial life. Astrobiology is the study of the origin, evolution, distribution, and future of life in the universe. There are a number of scientists from all over the country who are participating in this, and we're going to be eagerly anticipating and listening to the news conference. So we'll talk about it's not ET that they've discovered extraterrestrial life in terms of a being of some kind. I think we can rule that out, much as we would like to have that happen. But that's happening this afternoon. So we'll ask both our guests about this. We have two guests this hour. Chris Lintott is a postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Physics at the University of Oxford. He is co-founder of Galaxy Zoo and Zooniverse and co-author of Bang, The Complete History of the Universe. A little bit later, I was watching CBS News this week. I switched recently to CBS for some reason. You know, you go all over to get your news, but there was a great feature on Frank Kovac, who is the creator and director of the Kovac Planetarium, which is located in his backyard. He has spent 15 years building this. He works at a paper mill, but he hopes to devote more time to the planetarium, which is open to the public. So we'll talk about his passion for this and what he has built. And if you build it, as you know, they will come. So we hope to get some more people to drop into Monaco, Wisconsin, to look at his achievements. All hour, you are welcome to join our conversation. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Chris Lintott has been on our show before. We absolutely loved him, and we're just happy to have him on again. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Yeah, good. Thank you. It's good to be back.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. So we're not going to meet ET this afternoon?
Well, I'd be very surprised. I suspect NASA won't bother sending out the press conference details in advance for that one. But I think it does highlight the progress that's being made in trying to understand where we might find life in the universe.
Uh-huh.
The history of this subject is fascinating. You go back to the 50s before the space age, and people were convinced there were aliens everywhere. And then we went through, I think, quite a depressing period with the Viking missions to Mars in the 70s that didn't find any signs of life, where people thought maybe we were alone in the universe. But if you look at astronomy today, we see planets around pretty much any star that we look at, or at least we detect their signs. We see water throughout the solar system, whether it's on Mars or on moons of Jupiter and Saturn. And meanwhile, here on Earth, we're beginning to understand that life is incredibly good at coping with hostile conditions. And so if you put all of these things together, you begin to believe in a universe that might just be teeming with life.
Mm-hmm. And is it, some have speculated that they might tell us that life may be able to sprout up from places that we didn't even think life could form. In other words, is a different way to form life.
Well, exactly. I have to say I haven't seen the paper. I'm as much in the dark as you have. This is all linked to the publication of a paper in the Science Journal today. So I don't know what's going on either. But the kind of research that NASA's been looking at here on Earth is to determine where life can exist. And we have these amazing bacteria called extremophiles, and they're called that because they love extreme conditions. We found bacteria that exist in incredibly acidic conditions. We found bacteria that can cope with remarkable cold or extreme heat. And so there's this idea growing that life can pretty much handle whatever you can throw at it. And so that gives you hope that you don't need to find an exact copy of Earth with a nice temperate climate, oceans, and a suitable atmosphere. Maybe life could exist in more hostile places in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
There is one caveat, though.
Yes.
Which is that with all of these extremophiles on Earth, we're talking about things that have evolved since life got started. So these bacteria that can survive deeply acidic conditions, swimming around in sulfuric acid, they descended from bacteria that grew up in much more friendly conditions. And so what we don't know is whether life can get started in one of the in particularly hostile conditions, and that's a big area of research at the minute. So perhaps we'll know a little bit more about this after, 1 o'clock this afternoon?
Yeah, maybe that's what they discovered, huh?
Oh, perhaps. Yeah, let's hope so. I know they've been exploring, NASA-funded researchers have been all over the place looking at, for example, in the geysers at Yellowstone, these hugely sulfuric, acidic places, and looking for bacteria. So maybe the results will be something to do with that.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about extremophiles, didn't they discover something recently, these animals that can go from incredibly hot temperatures in the ocean, I'm thinking of, and then within a matter of moments go to a place that's really cold, and they can make that transition?
Absolutely. I mean, all of these sudden changes are things that I think in the past we would have thought that would have ruled out life. But we're discovering people are more tolerant. They're not like us needing heating in the winter and air conditioning in the summer. There's plenty of bacteria happy to live in the natural environment. Actually, one interesting experiment is a Russian one. They're sending a probe to Mars in about a year's time. The probe goes by the deeply unromantic name of Grunt, which means soil or earth in Russian, apparently. But the Grunt probe will head to Mars. It's going to go to one of Mars's moons, Phobos, and it's going to bring back a sample of Phobos to Earth, which is hugely exciting. But it's going to carry along for the ride a little petri dish of microorganisms. And the idea is to see whether they can survive a long journey in space.
Oh.
And if they could do that, then you have this old idea that maybe, at least within the solar system, you only need life to appear once. Let's say it started on Earth. But then we do see material transferred through impacts and asteroids to Mars or to Venus or to the outer outer planets. And so if bacteria can survive traveling through space, we may be able to get away with starting life once and then scattering it throughout the solar system.
Oh, my gosh. So how would they keep it alive if it made it through space?
So it's in a little contained environment. It's nicely sealed off from everything else. And there are lots of bacteria that go into a sort of state of hibernation. So you could put them in extreme conditions and you can have them last for hundreds of years and then regenerate when they're given the appropriate nutrients. So this is the equivalent of, you sometimes read about, you know, digging up in Egypt, digging up ancient seeds and then still being able to grow wheat.
Yes, right.
So it's the same sort of thing.
Oh.
So I don't expect the bacteria will be enjoying the view while they're on their way to Mars and back. But the idea is, can the cell survive so that when it gets back and we put it in some friendlier conditions, will it still be able to function?
Oh, that's fascinating. And tell me how all of this astrobiology could have an impact on the search for the evidence of extraterrestrial life. What's the link here?
Well, the link is this. If you understand astrobiology, you know what odds we have. So we've been trying on and off for about 30 to 40 years to look for intelligent life in the universe, to try and understand whether we're alone or not. But the big unknown in determining whether we're going to be successful or not is how likely it is that a given planet around a given star has life. If life is incredibly rare in the universe, then we could build the most powerful radio telescopes and listen in on every star in the galaxy and not hear anything. If life is common, if life appears wherever the conditions are right, then, you know, there really should be aliens out there. So we set the odds. If we understand the astrobiology, we can understand how likely it is that there'll be aliens out there for us to talk to.
Hmm. And does NASA have a lot of people working on this? Are there other places in the world working on this as well?
It's a huge growth area at the minute. So pretty much, I mean, NASA's working on it, but pretty much every astronomer I know, those who aren't worrying about the ultimate fate of the universe are thinking about astrobiology. Because one very interesting thing has happened. In the last decade or so, we've solved one of the big mysteries, which is that if we were talking 15 years ago, we would be having this conversation about whether planets existed. I'd be saying, well, if you want to know if there are aliens out there, then we need to know how likely it is that there are planets like Earth going around other stars. But we now have the technology to indirectly, admittedly, but to detect planets around other stars. And pretty much everywhere we look, we see them. We now know of more than 500 planets around other stars. We're probably less than a year or two away from being able to point at a star in the night sky and know that there's an Earth-like planet going around it, a rocky planet with water perhaps on the surface. There were results out this week. There was an atmosphere detected around a large, it's about three times the mass of the Earth, but a planet which probably has a rocky surface and an atmosphere that contains some water. And so planets are common. We have plenty of real estate. We didn't know that until now. And so the question has moved on to whether, you know, what there is to populate those planets.
Yes. Oh, my. Let's talk a little bit about what you're doing with citizen scientists. You have a very interesting project going on, mining British ship logs for old weather data from World War One ships.
That's right. This is in my copious spare time, because as you'll remember from last time we talked, we'd got the general public involved in classifying galaxies.
Yes.
Yeah, on the web at galaxyzoo.org. But this... So we noticed from this that the human brain is a wonderful thing. It can do many things that computers can't, and one of them is to read handwriting. And we were approached by a group of climate scientists who were trying to understand what might happen to our climate in the future. And they desperately wanted to get their hands on old observations of weather. Because if you understand what the weather was doing 100 years ago, you can test your computer models, your understanding on whether you could predict the weather 100 years ago, and that gives you confidence that we might be able to predict the future. And there's an old joke about predicting the past being much easier than predicting the future, but in this case, it's absolutely true. But all these observations are in these beautiful handwritten ship's logs. So every 4 hours, come hell or hell high water, the Royal Naval officers would record the temperature, the pressure, and so on. Even in the middle of a battle, you see these amazing logs. Yeah. It's, you know, enemy ship detected, temperature is 72 degrees, pressure is this. Fired on enemy ship, temperature is 73 degrees, pressure goes up a bit. And the observations are incredibly accurate. So we put these logs online at oldweather.org, and people are invited to come and help explore them. And we get the climate information, but we also get these wonderful personal stories that come out in this. It's a very terse... Because these are the official ship's logs, so you get glimpses of a story. I was just looking the other day. I'm now a huge fan of a man called Sub-Lieutenant Fardell of the HMS Minotaur, who not once but twice has got into trouble for distributing liquor to the crew.
Ooh.
On high days and holidays. So I'm desperately reading to find out what happens to him. He's been sent off to another ship at the minute, but I'm hoping he'll reappear.
Oh, Chris, you're great. Where are these logs? Where were they found?
They're in the National Archives.
Oh.
They're in these great big dusty boxes down in Kew, which is famous for Kew Gardens, just outside London. And they were there, but no one had brought them to light, and no one's put them on the web until now. So they've been lost to history. We've known where they are, but no one's had time to go through them.
I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say the interesting thing is it turns out that lots of other navies and lots of other countries have dusty boxes sitting all over the place. So I'm going down to North Carolina in a couple of weeks to go and have a look at the U.S. naval logs, and we'll see if we can find the American equivalent of Sub-Lieutenant Fardell and some climate information along the way.
Do you have a lot of volunteers looking at this?
Yeah, so far so good. We've had about 15,000 people something like that. And in 6 weeks, they've done something like 200,000 log pages.
Isn't that wonderful?
It's fantastic.
Yeah, that must make you feel so good. How's the handwriting?
Oh, well, it depends which ship you're on. Yeah, and some of them you can tell the classically trained, perhaps slightly better off officers who had a good education, this beautiful copper plate handwriting. And then sometimes, particularly in the middle of the battles, it gets a bit shaky from some of the others. But there's some interesting things going on with people. People pick it. You can follow on the site. You follow the journey of one particular ship. And people are incredibly loyal to the ship that they've picked. So even if your officer's handwriting is no good, people stay loyal and work their way through.
And this is at oldweather.org.
That's it, yep.
Oh, wonderful project. We're going to welcome phone calls for Chris. Chris Lintott is our guest. It's been a little while since we've had him on. He's a postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Physics at the University of Oxford. He is the co-author of Bang, The Complete History of the Universe. He is co-founder of Galaxy Zoo and Zooniverse, and he's done some absolutely wonderful and important projects asking citizens to be scientists, and thought that when he started his first project, there would just be a few. Well, it's turned out to be this huge number of people all over the world who want to participate in these scientific projects. And you just heard him describe the latest one where they're asking people to look at the logs for World War I ships to find out what weather patterns were so that they can predict future weather patterns based on the past. That's at oldweather.org. If you're interested. Also, if you want to go to zooniverse.org, you can find out some of their other projects. We're welcoming your phone calls. He's also, as you can hear, quite on top of what NASA is doing in terms of searching for extraterrestrial life. They're having a major news conference, 1 o'clock our time this afternoon, to talk about an astrobiology finding that will impact the search for evidence of extraterrestrial life. So, you know, anything star-related, old ship-related is up for discussion right now. Here's our phone number. Please call. We have a few minutes to take phone calls for Chris, and then we'll be speaking with Frank Kovac from Northern Wisconsin, who built this planetarium in his backyard. Our number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you would like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. You know, and to get things rolling here, you know, I could ask you if you think that it's a wise use of NASA's time, because this is a real timely thing today, to have a big department looking at astrobiology. And do you imagine that that will lead us to some of the huge discoveries that we've already had, and we're bound to have, as Chris says, many more of them, because we're getting pretty good at this and we're finding out a lot about other planets. So call us, will you please? Thanks. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Chris Lintott is our guest this hour. He has joined us before and can talk about everything related to the stars and speculating about what NASA might be telling us this afternoon at their major press conference and what projects he's up to these days. It's always something fascinating. Postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Physics at the University of Oxford. Are there other citizen science projects that are ongoing that you want to tell us about that you need help with, Chris?
Well, of course.
Okay.
Before I do that, I should say it's good that you mentioned Oxford. I'm actually spending a year in Chicago. So
oh, you are?
I'm talking to you from the basement of the Adler Planetarium.
You're kidding.
In Chicago. So, because they're heavily involved in it, in our projects.
Oh.
So I need to name check the people who are currently paying my salary. So,
I love the Adler Planetarium.
No, it's wonderful, isn't it?
The
best thing about being here is wandering upstairs, and instead of finding students, much as I love my students in Oxford, wandering upstairs and seeing school kids going nuts and people looking at everything, all the exhibits upstairs. So it's wonderful.
Oh, I'm so glad you're there. We should come visit you.
Yeah, please do. Come down. We can show off some of the things that we've got going on. Actually, one project that we're launching next week, another citizen science project, was inspired by exactly that experience I was talking about of wandering upstairs and looking at people. We've got this enormous, it must be 50, 60-foot display of an image of our galaxy taken from the Spitzer Space Telescope. So it's like a smaller infrared version of Hubble. And this image is glorious. It's got these beautiful colors, green and red and blues. And what it shows is the gas in our galaxy, and it has this wonderful bubbly structure. And you see people, when they come into the planetarium and they encounter this image, they walk along it very slowly. And to begin with, they're just looking at it, and then they start pointing out interesting things to their friends, because you can find newly formed stars in there, and you can see little knots and little patterns. I mean, whenever you see anything like this, you start seeing faces and so on. But one of the things that we want people to look for in this image is are bubbles. Because when you get a newly formed star, if you think teenage stars are perhaps a bit like teenage people, are violent and a bit unruly. And so you have these winds, these powerful winds that come off the young star, and they can blow away the gas and dust from around their cocoon, where they formed. And so when you see these bubbles, there's a sign that star formation is going on. And the image is way too complicated for people, for computers to look at. But if you have a close look, you can find these bubbles on all scales, little tiny ones and big, huge ones as well. So from next Tuesday, you can go to the Milky Way Project.org. You can always get to all of our projects from Zooniverse.org.
Okay.
And look for these bubbles. Tell us where stars are forming in the Milky Way. And we hope that we can trace out these stellar nurseries where stars and presumably planets that will lead to interesting things for astrobiologists are forming.
Oh, that's fascinating. Oh, I'm so glad you're at the Adler Planetarium. Maybe we can work out a little field trip.
Absolutely.
Listeners.
Or maybe I should probably come up to Wisconsin while.
Okay. That'd be a good idea.
Pay you a visit.
Thank you.
Or to the planetarium of your next guest, of course. Because, I mean, from what I've seen, his planetarium is an old rotating dome. Right?
Yes, it is.
We've got one of the original versions of that here, the Atwood Sphere, which is a wonderful thing. You go up inside it, and rather than a projector, you have the stars painted on the inside of a dome that turns around you. It's a fantastic way to show people the night sky.
Yes. Okay, well, we're going to get something rolling here beyond what's on the air. That's great. Ruth is calling you from on the road. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I just want you to know I have hands-free sex, so it's not like I'm having my cell phone to my ear.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I drive specially. Anyway, the reason why I called is this is also fascinating, and it's kind of Star Trek-ish to me, but you were talking about the World War One maritime, and I was just wondering how far back in the archives can you go for your shipping lanes, like in the 1700s, the 1800s, did they document the same kind of things that you're looking at in the World War One?
Excellent question. Yes, they absolutely do. So we picked World War One because there are particular gaps in the record there. But actually, people have looked back at older ships. We have a whole load of 19th century and 18th century records. And one really nice example of this is we've got the logs from the old fur trading companies up in Hudson Bay and up in what's now Canada, of course. And if you look at their tracks, they trace the edge of the ice because they were looking. Lots of them were looking for ways to get inland, perhaps even looking for the Northwest Passage. And so by following the track of the ship, you get a really detailed model of where the ice was at that particular time. So that's one nice example. Another one is somebody's already pulled out the weather observations from Darwin's voyage on the Beagle.
Oh, my.
And, of course, he went down south to South America, the Galapagos, and then up back round. And so that's an interesting part of the world. So we take anything we can get. There's a huge effort across the world at the minute to rescue these old weather observations because they're the keys to understanding how well we can predict the climate. And the ships are particularly fun because they move. And so if you're on land, you might have a particularly good lighthouse keeper off the coast of what's now Ethiopia, for example, and that's great, but the ship moves, and that gives you information about a huge part of the Earth's surface.
Oh, that's fascinating. Thank you, Ruth.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm just so very fascinated with all of this because our history really is our future.
Absolutely. We should steal that slogan.
Our history is our future.
I'll change the website immediately. Thanks, Ruth.
So how did you wind your way to Adler Planetarium?
Oh, well, it's funny because when I got into this business of citizen science, getting people involved in the process of science, we sort of stumbled across it. As you know, we have this problem of too many galaxies and needing people to help out. But in many ways, this getting the public involved in research is what Adler's always been doing. It's been here since 1930, and they've been thinking seriously about what to do with the vast data sets that are coming into astronomers' hands. There's a whole space visualization lab upstairs it doesn't do much for the radio, but produce these amazing 3D visualizations of data so we can really see what we've got. And so it was just a meeting of minds. We had, at the time, we had Galaxy Zoo up and running and lots of ideas, and they understand how to translate things to the public,
yes.
And they understand how to get school kids involved as well. So it's a bit of a marriage made in heaven, and I'm very happy to be in Chicago for a year. Apart from the weather, I have to say it suddenly got very cold, and I should have been aware that this was going to happen.
Yeah, but it's nothing compared to what's in England right now, right?
Well, that's true, yeah. No, we're buried in snow back at, all my friends back there are complaining, and here I am. It's about 31 today. in downtown Chicago.
Ah, so, piece of cake.
I'm going to go to the beach for lunch.
Are you doing any television now? We want to make you a public television
star.
Well,
I'm still doing my BBC series.
So are you?
We have the wonderful show The Sky at Night, which has been running since 1957,
wow.
So predates the space age, not with me.
No.
The main presenter is still Sir Patrick Moore, who's been on every episode.
Oh, my gosh.
Bar one. And we have our 700th program early next year. So I'm flying. I'm doing a bit of that still. But, yeah, if you have a TV contract going, I'll happily talk to anybody about anything, as you well know.
I can tell. Here you are at the Adler Planetarium. I didn't have a clue. Thank you very, very much. And maybe we can work something out where you come up here, and then we could take a little trip up to Rhinelander to see Frank's planetarium
in
his backyard.
I'd love to do that. Let's make it happen.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Chris.
Sure everyone goes to zooniverse.org in the meantime.
Yes.
I'll look for Wisconsin classifications streaming in shortly.
All right. Thanks, Chris. Chris Lintott. I love this guy. Postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Physics at the University of Oxford. But for this year, he is at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago. What do you think, everybody? I'm this is just coming to mind as we're doing this show. But wouldn't it be fun to take a busload of people down to the Adler Planetarium and have this guy as our guide? Ah, what a day. It would be wonderful. If you're interested, let us know. That would be. Oh, I also meant to tell you, because we've got this Facebook. I haven't talked about it. I just assume everybody's on Facebook. But for those of you who don't know, we are on Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And when we get to a couple thousand fans, we do this thing where we go through books that we have and we kind of randomly pick Facebook friends and send you a book, which is a little treat. Kind of fun. So if you want to become a fan, that would be dandy. But if you'd like to do a trip like this, let us know, because that's how we went to Springfield and that's why we're going to Washington. But Chicago's just a hop, skip, and a jump. And I grew up in Chicago, so the Adler Planetarium was also always a huge treat to go to that planetarium. It is just wonderful. And to have him as our guide couldn't be better, don't you think? All right, we're off and rolling. Well, I was watching CBS News this week, and they did a feature, and it was a beautiful feature with Frank Kovac. Frank is the creator and the director of the Kovac Planetarium near Rhinelander, Wisconsin. This is a remarkable planetarium that Frank, who works at a paper mill still, did this whole planetarium. He built the planetarium himself. And it is open to the public now, so that you can go and see his creation. It's quite remarkable. And we're just delighted to have Frank here. He'll talk about his journey to build the world's largest mechanical globe planetarium, what it was like as a kid to be with his dad, and his late father took time, he says, to show him the stars. And because of his father, the world now has the fourth and largest mechanical globe planetarium. And we're going to be talking with him. He also painted every star that's visible to the unaided eye in the northern hemisphere inside the 22-foot diameter globe. He painted all of those. This was done with a great deal of knowledge and painstaking research. So we're going to talk to Frank about this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk. We already have an email for Frank. talk@wpr.org. Frank, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello, Eric. Nice to be with you, too.
Yeah, great to have you here. I was so happy to see you on CBS News. You've built this extraordinary thing, and I'm sure that as a result of that, you've been getting phone calls from many, many people wondering about your planetarium.
Yes, since they aired that story, it's just been unbelievable how many people say they were touched by the story, mainly because somebody did this on their own. Not that I haven't had assistance at times, but I would say about 90% of the project was done over a period of 15 years, all the way from the thought, the dream, to the completion, kind of like climbing a mountain, reaching for the peak. And there were many times where I struggled along the way, but I've had calls from all over the nation and people from other parts of the world saying they saw that segment on CBS, and they said that now the dreams that they're pursuing are just really going to go forward because they say that they've always lost hope on what they want to do in life. But by seeing this, now they said it brought them almost to tears even.
Well, I hope that many, many people come and see your planetarium. And I don't know if you heard our conversation. This is a gentleman we discovered some time ago, Chris Lintott, who does this, the night sky program in the UK, and is now at the Adler Planetarium. And he wants to come up and see your planetarium. And so we're thinking of doing that together. And we're going to go down to Adler as well. So prepare for a visitor. Who's a wonder?
Yes, I did hear the segment, and it's very nice. And I've gone to the Adler Planetariums many times, and I have really enjoyed their showings there. And I have nowhere near the planetarium on that scale. But as far as for northern Wisconsin, this is actually, they call it a hidden treasure.
Yes, I believe it is. And it is the fourth and largest mechanical globe planetarium.
Correct. When I started thinking about this idea, I thought I was going to have the only one ever of an entire globe tilted at the proper latitude to match where you are on the planet, which this is the 45th parallel up here. So it's pointing actually to the North Star. It didn't have to, as far as its orientation is in that direction. It could have been pointing at a 45-degree angle anywhere in this structure that it's housed in. But it made sense that if I was to construct this, and if it ever did work, it would be already in that orientation once I tilted it after I got it constructed. And, of course, I did some research, and lo and behold, on a trip to the Adler Planetarium, there in their basement is the Atwood Sphere. It's a globe-style planetarium with not painted stars inside, but with holes drilled through the sheet metal. And I believe they've added a little paint to highlight the constellations. There's about 600 holes drilled, and this thing within a few years will be 100 years old. So then I thought, well, I wonder if there were any more of these. And sure enough, in Germany, there was one, I believe, called the Gottrop Globe. It now resides in St. Petersburg, Russia, and it was the first of those type. It's 10 feet in diameter, and back then it was powered by water. So I had no idea how historical these globes were. And CBS, of course, was happy to get the story. And I've had other news organizations out here, but never did I have national news like this. And, of course, the area people here are just so excited that we got CBS here.
Oh, and how did you get CBS there, Frank?
Well, during this past summer, one of the employees there, the vice president of CBS, he was on a trip to this area with some relatives, and they stopped in for a show, and he quickly contacted them and said that there's something amazing here. And then, of course, a few months later, I got a call, and Assignment America, Steve Hartman, picked up on it, and they came here about a month ago, and it just finally aired.
Oh, I'm so happy for you. It's just wonderful. Well, let's go back in time, and let's go back in time to when your father took time to show you the stars. It obviously was a wonderful connection with him and the beginning of a lifelong interest.
Right. I actually grew up right in the city of Chicago, right near downtown, so I'm from the big city. And my dad was from another part of the world. He actually came over to this country in the year 1958 from Yugoslavia when there was problems over there with wars, and his father was taken away in a concentration camp.
Oh, my.
They never saw him again.
Hmm.
And they changed their name from a German name to Kovac, which my name was originally, with K-O-V-A-C-H. Well, then the mail got mixed up with his brother, who in Chicago, he said, could you take the H off your name? And then, of course, it turned out to be Kovac, where it stays that way now in my dad's side. My dad passed away in the year 1997 from cancer.
Hmm.
And, of course, when I was 13 years old, he had a small telescope and a little map of the sky. In a big city, you don't see the stars very well, so I looked at what I could see. And then on trips to Wisconsin over the years, I thought, wow, I could see those stars that I couldn't see before. And, of course, trips to the local planetarium, the big Adler Planetarium, inspired me. And I was just so awed that I was so focused on the stars that I knew there was something that I was going to do one day, but it was always nagging at me that I wanted to open this up to the public. So my dad kind of set off the spark, and now the flame continues to burn, and many visitors that come to my planetarium see his picture when they come in, and I have it in the front there on a sign, and it's now dedicated as the Frank Kovac Senior Planetarium, and he is the one who inspired me just by taking time with his child to look up at the stars. And ever since that time, I grabbed every book I could, and I was always amazed when I saw the show Cosmos as a teenager growing up, and I was inspired by Carl Sagan's Cosmos, and I read a lot of books, but I have no college degree. But I have a passion for the stars, and I can now share that with lots of people. And many people actually, after seeing my show, about an hour and a half long, tell me that they feel so inspired about the beauty of our universe and touched by this invention that can now open up the universe to people who actually don't even realize how beautiful it really is. You just have to take the time to look up at the sky and realize how much we are part of that universe. Earth is 1 million times smaller than our own star. And when people find that out, that there's other stars out there that would hold millions of suns, they're just like, you can't believe it. So it's just the basics people get by me. I am not a scientist, but I open it up. And then from there, even the child that came to my show said, I want to go to Mars. I want to go to Mars. He was 10 years old. And I could see he had the passion I had to build this. And I said to him, study hard and keep going, and you'll reach your goal.
Right. Oh, that's just a wonderfully heartwarming story, Frank. Now, tell me, this was a heck of a lot of hard work. How did you know how to build a planetarium? How do you know how to construct it?
Well, my first idea was to buy a projecting system, and when I was looking at quality ones that really do produce a very nice image, I could never afford it on a meager wage, and I thought, wow, you know, there must be a way. I remember this glow-in-the-dark paint that I put on my ceiling in my house, and I thought, wow, you know, that stuff looks neat, but I bet you if it was inside an entire globe, that would really look neat, and you could replicate the night sky with luminous paint. But most people think, what a foolish thought, because you can't ever produce the same image that a machine can do. And then how would you make it look like it moves, like the seasons of stars come around you? That is where the projectors turn. So I thought, well, if I build an entire globe and rotate it, that's where my idea came up to me in about the year 1994. And it was just a lot of thought and looking at amusement rides, how things move.
Oh.
I never knew these things existed, so I never saw the Atwood globe before I started designing mine. But then, not only is this one very unique in its way that it's the only one in the world that has all those stars painted with luminous paint in their proper location and brightness. So it was, the beginning was taking lots of plywood, cutting them into circles, gluing them together, a lot of wood screws, and countless hours for years, and then many setbacks. This thing was nowhere in my mind going to work because there was a lot of problems with the mechanical operation of turning 4,000 pounds around the audience and filling it with seats, with bench-type seats, and then getting that whole thing to work. But it was not even in a building. It was outside in this cold shelter, and I could only work on it usually when the weather warmed up. So it was almost like a drive that there was something pulling me to get this done. And I had to convince not only myself but my neighbors that I didn't lose my mind. And all those years, I finally got it to turn in the year 2002 with a motor, with the help of a neighbor. And then once I got it to rotate, then I knew it would work. Then I needed a building. So mostly built with paychecks over a period of, I would say, 6-7 years. And then the rest of the time, I had to go get the loans because, of course, I needed contractors to pour concrete,
right.
Well drillers. So here in northern Wisconsin, we have a lot of bedrock, a lot of granite in the ground, and getting water in certain areas is almost a nightmare. So I had to have a facility with restrooms and all that. So that's where it came out to be more extensive. But I had just about every contractor that came there almost like fall over when they saw this. They said, we've done houses, but we've never seen anything like this. And they said, this is the most amazing thing they've ever seen. And I now feel that it's nice that I can let the public come and see it.
Oh, yes. And you save money. You work at a paper mill. Do you still work there?
Yes, they have me there during kind of the off-season time right now, helping out with organizations as far as shelving and parts and stuff. So that gives me some income during the slower times here. But during Memorial Day weekend to Labor Day weekend, I average about 15 people per day. So it's very good then. But this time of year, I do get groups, especially around the holidays. And now since the CBS story ran, it has been to where people from all over the country are saying, we are coming to Wisconsin.
Hooray!
We want to find out where we can camp. And so I answer just about every email so far. I've got about 100 of them since the CBS story aired. And most of them are very positive, and people are saying that we definitely are coming to Wisconsin, and you put northern Wisconsin on the map now.
On the map of the world, right? Oh, this is just a wonderful story. Frank Kovac is our guest this part of the program. He's built a planetarium, and it's a remarkable planetarium in Monaco, Wisconsin, very near Rhinelander. It is the fourth and the largest mechanical globe planetarium, and you heard about the inspiration and the 15 years that it took for him to build his dream. So we're going to take phone calls for him. If you would like to join the conversation, here's the number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. I saw a report on this on CBS News. Don't you love it when you see something and you think, oh, that'd be great for a program, and how that happened to come to CBS News as well? That's just quite a story. And I'm sure that Frank will give his email address, too, in case you would like to bring a group to hear the presentation, which I'm sure is quite thorough and quite inspirational, as Frank is. Here's our phone number. Please join us, 800-486-8655. Our email address, and we already have a couple emails that have come in, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for you, Frank, and let's start with Tony from Barrington, Illinois. Hi, Tony.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a long-term amateur astronomer, and I have a home in Boulder Junction.
Oh.
And I would like to have the address so we can get there.
Okay. You may want to give the email address to Frank, because people will want to see this and know the hours of operation, et cetera.
Sure. The location for the planetarium is 4.5 miles east of a little town called Monaco. It's going down Highway 45. You would turn left on U.S. Highway 8, and then there's really nothing there but a little white arrow sign along the highway, and that is where you turn left about 4.5 miles east of Monaco, Wisconsin, on U.S. Highway 8. And then you would see Mud Creek Road, M-U-D Creek Creek Road, and then the address is 2394 Mud Creek Road, Monaco, Wisconsin, 54501, and of course titled Kovac Planetarium. And then the email address is F for Frank, K-O-V-A-C for Kovac, at KovacPlanetarium.com.
KovacPlanetarium.com.
Right, F. Kovac at KovacPlanetarium.com.
Okay.
And you can see that on the website, Kovac Planetarium. There's a contact link there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony.
Tony, for calling.
Yeah, have fun. And you can also, if you go to CBS News, you can see the feature that they did in case you didn't see the report earlier this week on Frank. Here's an email that has come in from Corey in Rhinelander, Frank. My grandson and I visited Frank's planetarium a couple years ago. Let me tell you firsthand what an amazing sight it is. Well worth the visit. Frank is an excellent presenter. He is passionate about the sky. No question goes unanswered, as his knowledge is limitless.
Well, thank you for that email, Corey, and I do remember you.
Let's go to Allison, who's driving. Hi, Allison.
I'm on my way up. I have a place on Plum Lake, which is north of Rhinelander, a little Boulder Junction, where the last guy has a place. And I was going to say, if you wanted to bring Chris up to see his planetarium, I'm going to stop on my way up, because I'm just outside of Stevens Point right now. But I thought if you wanted to go up there with a group, you can stay at my cottage. We've got room for 10 people. It's a place built in the 20s. It's very pretty, so you can make a weekend of it. Bring Chris from England, and you guys can go.
Oh, this is getting better and better with every moment. Send us an email, Allison.
I will.
I'll send pictures.
We had 4 inches of snow last week. I don't know if it's still there. I'm just heading back up. So. Anyway, I'm coming to this planetarium. I can't wait. Bring my nephews there.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, thank you, Allison.
Thanks. Thanks so much. What kinds of hours do you have? How often are you open?
Well, this time of year, I open up per reservation. So if I have just two people, they'll get a show. I've even done a show for one person, or if I can seat up to about 25 comfortably in there. It's heated. It's indoors. The weather is not a factor as long as the roads are clear and people can get here. And my hours are, during the summer, usually 11 a.m., then there's a 2 p.m. showing, and then also sometimes a 4 or a 7 o'clock evening one. And then if there's interest after the show times, in the later show time hours during the summer or the nicer weather season, people are offered viewing through telescopes that I do have out here. And this is pretty remote, so you are far from city lights here, and you can see that beautiful Milky Way that many of us really don't see anymore, and that's what people are fascinated about, especially when they travel north into the Northwoods of Wisconsin, because we're quite remote here, far from the city lights, where most people can't see the real sky, how it really does look in its beauty.
Is that why you picked that spot in which to live?
Yes, when I first looked for property in this area after coming out of the U.S. Air Force, I thought, wow, you know, I want to find a place where can really see the sky very well, and of course I'm 20 miles east of Rhinelander, and there is lots of timberland around here, so you're, like CBS said, it's one of the most remote planetariums. Most planetariums are very much in a town or a city, but to have one in someone's backyard, you find that kind of unusual. But
I would say so.
Right.
Thank you, Allison. Let's go to Mary from Wausau. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I just want to tell Frank hello. I've been to his planetarium twice this summer. The first time I stumbled upon it with my husband and my sister and her husband from Virginia, and we left. My sister and I were both crying because It is one of the most inspirational stories and just such a beautiful man he is. We brought our grandchildren back, and I would encourage anyone to bring your children there. And I think anybody who has family who's struggling with what do I do, and this is just the answer to someone's idea of where passion can take you. And Frank he puts on a wonderful show. He has no notes. He's just this incredible man, and I'm so grateful that he's getting this attention. I have tried. I've passed out his brochures to everybody I know, and I'm just so delighted this moment has come for him. So thank you, Frank.
Well, thank you, Mary, and I appreciate your call. And it's if you get a chance, you can check out Assignment America CBS if you haven't seen the story. And they did a wonderful story on me, and it's online now on the planetarium.
It is a wonderful story. It certainly caught my attention. Mary, thank you so much for the call. I'm going to end this show in tears. Steve is calling next. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, I was wondering if he knows every night since he's in Wisconsin here, before it gets dark, when the sky is still blue, there's a big, huge, what looks like a star, possibly our planet, that comes out before the stars even come out.
Right.
And it looks really low, and I've searched on the internet, and people are saying it's the new planet and all this other kind of stuff. Do you know what it is?
Which direction are you looking?
Well, it's in different places, in different nights. I mean, just, you can't miss it. I mean, before, the sky's still blue, and it's, I mean, it looks low to me.
Right. What the brightest object is right after sunset right now, if you look high up in the southeast, is the planet Jupiter, which is very distinct. It shines very steady and bright. And then as the night goes on, as our planet turns, it's going to look like it's moving toward the west, just like our sun would. But then there's other times where you see something just the same brightness as Jupiter. And what you're looking at is the International Space Station, if it's moving like a satellite. And many people can see that sometimes go across the sky within about 3 minutes. So if that station is 200 miles above us, it's it's reflecting our sunlight onto it, coming back to Earth. And then, of course, it's about the size of a football field, so it has a lot of reflection off all those solar panels. And if you watch it, and if it heads toward the east as they go around our planet, it will look like it kind of dims out because it's falling into Earth's shadow. That's where the astronauts see our sunset. But it could be that, and many people see that, and sometimes it looks like it's sitting there for a bit. But if you stop to look, it is moving 17,500 miles per hour around Earth every 90 minutes. So, but otherwise, other than that, or Jupiter, I really don't know what you might be seeing. There is a...
We need to stop at that point, too, because we're out of time, Frank, and I want to give your address again. Okay. Thank you so much. It was just a great pleasure to meet you and hear your story.
Well, thank you so much, Kathleen, and this was really, really a nice opportunity, and I am so grateful for all your listeners, too.
Yeah, thank you. If you want to find out more about his remarkable construction, it's F. Kovacs, K-O-V-A-C, at KovacPlanetarium.com. And if you want to take this trip, let's plan a trip. We probably want to do summertime, but we have to do it in the next year while Chris is still at Adler. We'll work something out so we can go to Frank's Planetarium, too. I love this idea. Send us a message on the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook. Thanks, everybody. Thanks to Rhonda and Chrissy.